Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why episode 250, my chat with improviser Jay Sugo. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. Today's episode is sponsored by Audible. Get your free audiobook download and your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. I'm here to report another parenting win for Audible. I was just recommended a book on dealing with my 3-year-old, and when I found out that I could get it on Audible, I practically cried. My eyes are too tired to read anything but kids' books, but I really need this advice, so thank goodness for Audible. Audible is available on most devices. Go now to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy to download the app and sign up to get your free audiobook today. Today's other sponsor is my company, PodcastCadet.com. My husband Chris and I run the company PodcastCadet.com. We provide advice and production help to any podcaster who needs it. We can give you a little push, or we can help you with the production of all of your podcast episodes. Contact us now at podcastcadet.com and use code YBY20 to get 20% off the first service or workshop you buy. This week on Yes But Why, we had the opportunity to talk to Jay Sugo, founder of Today Improv. Jay Sugo is a director, writer, actor, and podcaster, as well as an award-winning improv performer and instructor. Jay hosts an online improv show called 10 Minutes With, and it features Jay playing with improvisers from across the globe. In our conversation, we chat about how much we love improv and making people laugh. We talk about using the skills of improv to embrace failure and adjust to change, and how much that has helped during the COVID shutdown. This was a delightful conversation filled with sage advice and joyful stories. I now present to you Yes But Why episode 250. Improviser Jay Sugo creates laughter and joy. Have fun listening. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
When I was in, like, high school, I was cast as Huck Finn in The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. I was a freshman. I didn't think, though, I was going to do it any, you know, as a career or I want to do it. I just had fun doing it, but I definitely did not think, oh, this is what I want to do. Until I started taking improv classes and I did my first class show, which was after our third term, we put on a show at the very end. And I remember that first hearing the audience laugh. It wasn't even laughing for something I said. It was just that first laugh and seeing a room full of people. And I thought, I want to make people laugh. I just remember that thought pretty early on. It's like, oh, I like making people laugh. And so finding improv really gave me that outlet. And I said, ooh, this, I want to keep doing this. I didn't know it would turn into a career, but I definitely enjoyed doing it.
Didn't know it would turn into a career, but you liked it enough to stick with it for quite a long time. Where was your first class? Where was this exciting first performance?
Oh, my parents gave me improv classes as a Christmas present one year. And oh, wow. I took classes at a place called Second City Northwest, which was the suburban home theater for Second City. They had a theater in the suburbs of Chicago, as well as the two theaters in Chicago, the city itself. So I was finishing up my last year at college, and I was driving up for a Saturday noon class to take improv, and I loved it. And I loved the sense that it was a collective art form and that you created something as a group. I was an athlete as a kid, and so I enjoyed the team aspect. And I found something that was similar to sports. And I just kept taking classes. To me, early on, it was really about this group. My classmates became really special. And so if after the third term, they said, we're going to go take salsa lessons, I would have said, sounds good, and never done improv because it was that group of people that I liked hanging out with. So that was how I got started with improv. Is it was a Christmas present, and the teachers I had were amazing, and the class I was in was amazing, and you just took the next class and the next class. And again, it wasn't like I want to do this for a living. It was, this is like super fun. Oh, we get to do a show for our friends and family. How great.
That's awesome. Where'd you go to college?
Yeah. I was going to Illinois State University in beautiful, normal Illinois, right in the center of the state. And I was driving up to the suburbs of Chicago in Rolling Meadows to take my improv class. And it would take like 2 or 3 hours to drive each way. And then I would go back to college. I would come in on a Saturday. Sometimes I would stay the night. Sometimes I would just turn around and go drive back to school. But it was my last semester. So instead of staying around and partying or anything like that, my party was improv. I would go up and I had so much fun. And then I'd drive back to school.
Oh, that's awesome, man. Improv is quite the party. Absolutely.
Right.
Oh, man. Why do you think your parents got that for you? Like, what is it about that they thought you'd like?
I keep thinking about this because it's so long ago. I keep thinking, why would they do that? And part of me is they might have heard an interview about Second City on the radio or saw something about it on TV that made them say, oh, we think you'd like this. I think that must have been it. I remember I had seen a stand-up show in Chicago at a place called the Funny Firm. And before the stand-ups, this group came out and they were called the Funny Firm Players. And they did like improv games, and I liked that too. So maybe I had talked about that to my parents. I just don't, I don't know what it was. I never got a chance to ask them like, hey, why did you get me classes? So either I said something in passing or they heard something about it. My, you know, I shared a sense of humor with like my dad, and I always had a love of comedy. He would wake me up on Sunday nights to watch like Fawlty Towers and My Two Ronnies, the Ernie Kovac Show. These were all in public broadcasting in Chicago. And so Sunday night, he'd wake me up and I'd watch these shows, and I would understand some of it. And then I would laugh watching my dad laugh. And I was like, oh, I like my dad's laughing. And then I would laugh at that. So some of the stuff I didn't quite understand, but we definitely shared a love of humor. And so that might have also had a hand in it.
No. Yeah. If you guys shared that. Also, like, I wonder if like your dad was like, oh man, I wish I could take this class. Oh, I'll give this to Jay. He'll like it.
Yeah, I think my dad's dream was to be like a radio disc jockey. I think he ended up being an iron worker.
Sure.
But I think if he could have done anything, it would have been that. So I think he did have a sense of like, you know, entertaining people, and he was a funny storyteller and joke teller. And I thought maybe, yeah, he thought this might inspire him. This might, you know, give him a hobby or something to stimulate the sense of humor. And so let's see if he likes this. Like I had done stand up once and it didn't stick with me. I appreciated stand-up. I loved watching stand-ups, and I thought they were funny, but it wasn't for me. I didn't like the feeling of being up there by myself. I liked the feeling of what really attracted me to improv, too, is like, oh, let me set this other person up to get the laugh. Like, I really dug that. I was like, oh, I'm going to give the laugh. I really like playing, like, in the straight comedic role. I like playing the straight character who sets the other person up. And so that was something in improv that really – struck a chord with me because I could make other people look good. And so that to me was always very attractive, is let me give you the laugh. Let me set you up to look good. And then I'll look good as well because you got the laugh.
Yeah. You know, I love improv in the ways that it is egalitarian. You know, I mean, it's for everybody. It's not like you have to go to Juilliard to do improv, right? And, you know, yeah. Thinking about your dad and people like him who are like funny in their lives, but like just don't have the ability to have an outlet where they get to, you know, go do improv classes or something like that. Like, there are so many people, but like now they do. You know what I mean? Like now, right. Now a guy working, you know, a steel worker in Pittsburgh can go take improv classes if he wants to, just to like, you know, shake off some of the rough, you know, work stuff and whatnot. You know, that's the beauty of it. It's not just like, oh, and people always say that, you know, when they were first trying to sign up for classes, they'd be like, well, you know, I mean, like, you don't want to be a performer. I'm like, nope, you don't have to be. It's all good. Just come hang out with us. It's just about doing bits and yes. Hanging out. Like,
and that's the thing is people, a lot of people, when they take improv go, oh, I used to do this when I was a kid with my friends. I didn't know it was called improv.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Totally.
Like, yeah.
You know,
that's
I teach...
it. That's what we're doing.
I teach level one, and that's my, like, first goal when I'm teaching a level one class. It's to get the group to become friends. Like, so yeah. My first, like, three classes are just to get them to be friends with each other. Because once they're friends mm-hmm. with each other, then it's, like, much easier to do improv, right? They have a shorthand. They know a little bit more about each other. They also feel easy to rib one another. So nobody feels bad about, like, making somebody the villain. God, the first few classes where they're like, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to make you. It's like, oh, my God, guys. Guess what? We're all going to be villains at some point. Sometime you're going to be the guy who's like, yeah, you can't have the party here. Like, I'm sorry. That's just sometimes you got to be the bad guy in the scene. It's all right. Nobody hates you.
Well, and that's, I think, one of the hardest transitions that people make is realizing none of this is personal against or for you. That's why we're doing characters, because if you keep referring to me by my name in these scenes, then I'm going to take things more personally than if it's like, no, you're just fulfilling what's needed in the scene. What's needed? Do they need someone to come out and be the bad person? Okay, I'll step up and be that. I know it's not a reflection on me personally. The same with like failing, like to be able to embrace failure in general, I think is a huge gift that I've gotten from improv. And mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you are a failure. It just means you're okay failing, and we should be more okay failing in life.
Yeah. Yeah. And plus most failures aren't really even failures. They're just like different doors to go different places. And that's both improv and in real life.
Everything I look at failures, like those become the gifts. And if you play you know, it's a jazz philosophy of play the wrong note again. Mm-hmm. Don't just play it like play it once, play it many times. Let the failure become a pattern and a gift to propel forward. And if you want to do comedy especially, you got to embrace that.
Right? Yeah. I mean, you 100% have to like get into, I mean, it's like when I teach comedy writing to people and they're like, but why would he make that mistake again? Because he's gonna. Because that's what a comedy character does. Guess what?
He's
probably gonna keep making that mistake over and over. He might never, here, hold on to your hats. He might never learn a lesson.
As soon as you learn the lesson, it's over.
See, it's over. It isn't, we do not need to do it, right? And like, relieve yourself the pressure of having to solve a problem. Oh. Don't solve it. Make it worse.
Always. It's like if there's a car on fire, you walk into that scene with gasoline, hot dogs, s'mores, The worst thing to do is, and what people battle against all the time is you want in life, we want to make things better, right? We don't want people to be in pain. We don't want them to feel bad. Right. If there's a car on fire, you're going to put it out. But it's playing the opposite in the scenes. You want to add to it. You want to make things worse. You can do it in a way also what makes you appear to care about the situation, but then you end up making it worse anyway. That, to me, is where the fun lies.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Making it worse is the best, for sure.
And giving those people who come in, level one, to me, is such an important level to teach, like the intro, to let people know, come in, it's going to be fine. Yeah. I love the way you're talking about it, like, your job is to make these people become friends. And if you look around an improv class, it's funny. The first level, especially the first class, you're like, there's not a huge percentage of chance that these people would hang out in life, but yeah. They have to. And then once they hang out in class and you go, you're here to help people be okay. You be okay with yourself and let other people be okay with being themselves. And then magical things happen in those groups, right? For sure.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. We, a few years ago when I was teaching, there were this set of two 12 person classes that just like burst forth all of a sudden. It was like we had one class and then they're like, there's a ton of people signing up. And I was like, make two classes. So then they made these two classes and there were these two level ones that were just bursting at the seams that were both 12 people each, right? And that those groups were so tight-knit. They stayed together through all five of the levels. Like they, as soon as they met, they were just like, we are 12 best friends now. And like, it was amazing. Like when they graduated, they were all like hugging and crying. And you're right. These people were like, they never would have met each other. Right.
No.
Cause it's rare that an improv class actually has, all actors. Right. Yeah. Use your handful of like, I want to be a performer and like, oh yeah, I do this because it helps me when I'm doing my film acting. Sure. Couple of those here and there. But usually it's just your average Joe. Like I'm a real estate agent and I need to be able to talk off the cuff. We had one guy who was a travel writer, right? And he had a hard time traveling and talking to the people, and he had to interview everyone when he went traveling. And he was just like having a tough time with it. And he just took a year of improv and then he was like, I'm good. I'm ready. I can do this. And then he's back on the road, right? Like what? I love it.
I mean, that's the thing is most of the people who enroll in an improv class are not there for any other reason than self-improvement. I want to learn how to speak better in my job. I want to learn how to be more social. I want to help overcome anxiety. I had a bad breakup. Like we hear these, I wanted to do something for myself this year. Even actors who are like, I want to improve. They're all there looking for ways to get better as a human. And this, through a series of learning to play games, you become a better human being, you become more present, you listen better, we have discounted the sense of play that is so important for humans, especially in adults. We have discounted that. Play is the last thing on a lot of people's list when it's really the most important thing is that sense of play. And now with what's happening currently in this global the pandemic that's going on, you need that positive, that laughter, that play now more than ever.
Yeah. If you're not like, if you don't have play in your heart, like going through this must be much harder, you know, because there's been so many things where I'm all like, what happened today? Great. Add it to the board. Like, it's not like, you know, like I'm not upset about things, you know, and we were talking earlier about how failures are helpful, man. It's sure been helpful that I know how to deal with not having enough money to pay all the bills. Well, I figured that. I got that. What? Oh, that's the only skill I have to use, right? I'm fine. I got that one. So we're done. We're good. Right?
And you also go, everything changes. Like an improv scene. Everything's going to change.
Yeah.
What's happening now is not going to be the way things are, good or bad. It's always going to change. Okay. And we're in a very uncertain time. And if anything, improv teaches you how to be okay with the uncertain, to be okay with the unknown, and to look into situations saying, I'm going to be fine. This is something that I might learn from. It seems scary right now, but I'm going to get through this like I've done my whole life.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So earlier before we started recording, you mentioned that when you were doing improv, you were kind of doing it because it was like easy to do, but then somehow tumbled into it making it your lifelong career. How did we get there? Like I'm deep in the thick of our improv chat, but like you are so clearly soaked up in improv. You are an improviser through and through. How did you go from like random funsy class to I'm in it to win it? This is me. What's going on?
Interesting. Yeah. A lot of people I think that I came up with and trained with and performed with early on, we all had the same attitude, which is this is a dead end job. Thank goodness. It's not going anywhere. We get to just play, but there's no pressure of doing anything. And so a strange thing happened along that way is that, there became more opportunities. I started teaching, I started performing, and getting like gift cards for holiday parties. And you're like, what? I'm getting a $20 gift card? Oh yeah. Look at this. And then pretty soon that somebody said, hey, I have a, I'm a real estate agent and we're having this meeting and we talk about listening and some of the skills I'm using in here really help out. Can you come teach us a couple of these exercises? And then it's like, okay. And then that turned into, hey, we're having, a sales conference. Can you come in between our speakers and do something? And so it just started becoming more acceptable. It's the corporate world. And the business folks started seeing this and going, hey, these skills I'm learning here apply to what we do. And we're trying to always, be here now is a phrase that kept popping up and it's in the corporate world. And it's like, well, that's, moment to moment and staying present. That's what we've been doing in improv for years. So we started going, how can we relate this to that world? And then we started facilitating improv workshops in that way. Classes started exploding in popularity. You started having more, there were business books about improv. And so businesses were always looking to improve their communication. And the next thing you know, it's like, wow, I turned this hobby, which started off as into this is my career for almost 30 years. And it started very slowly. And now, there are people taking improv classes. There are some places where you can take a class at 4 years old. They offer improv classes all the way up to retired folks. So there's people are starting to see it and accept it. It's starting to sneak into the zeitgeist. It's starting to sneak into the vernacular. When you started seeing like SNL make fun of improv, you're like, we've made it. Like they've heard of it. They've started making fun of it. It used to be like people would say, what's improv? And I'd go, have you ever seen Saturday Night Live? It's kind of like that, but we make it up. And they didn't quite get it. Then Whose Line came along and that changed the game and people had a reference point. And then the next thing you know, it's like, wow, I'm doing corporate learning and I'm teaching improv exercises and philosophies to help people become more effective communicators. I'm also doing, improv shows where I come in and it's either for a holiday party or I might use improv games to create a show in front of a business where we, you know, we talk, we address some of their issues using improv games or maybe writing sketches or something. So it's really gone from there's no need for this outside of these classrooms or maybe a second city stage. You know, when I started, it was like, I think there were probably 10 jobs in improv that paid and they were all on the second city stage. So if you were not one, and that was mostly sketch, it was very little improv on the second city stages. They used it to create material, but definitely it was not like you can make money doing improv. And then I got hired to work at Comedy Sports in Chicago. And I think my first show, I got $3 and I thought I made it. I was like, $3, man, awesome. And then these groups started popping up, and a group like, you know, Mission Improvable, they started touring, and you could get paid a living wage just doing improv games, touring the country. So it went from this is good at Second City to create sketch to know it could stand on its own as an art form to, oh, these exercises can help us become better as professionals. And so that's where we are now. Now we're at a point where it's like, oh, I can go into a business and I can teach them how to be more effective communicators. I can teach them how to give more dynamic presentations. I can teach them how to bring more empathy to their situation. So a lot of things have changed. And with that, improv has grown exponentially. And you have books on the market now using improv philosophies to help with business situations. So it's a completely different world than it was when I started. And honestly, if it was this way when I started, I probably wouldn't have gone into improv because it's like, oh no, there's too much of a chance of something happening. I didn't want that when I first started.
Oh man. I mean, are you mostly doing, I mean, now I don't know what you're doing,
yeah,
but are you mostly doing corporate improv stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, in December of this past year, so December of 2020, I did about 12 corporate improv shows, which is crazy. Like improv, just straight up improv shows. And then on top of that, I did 10 training, like communications workshops. And this is just in 1 month. So it was because of what's happened with the pandemic, everything's gone virtual and everything's, you know, I had a company called Windy City Fieldhouse reach out to me, and that's a company I used to do team building work for in Chicago. And they said, hey, we're putting, we're having a new offering where we want people to choose for their holiday experiences. And we have a magician lined up and we have wine tasting. Do you do virtual improv shows? I go, yeah, I've been doing virtual improv since March. And then they ended up booking out a lot of shows. And so we would go into these businesses, you know, virtually, and it'd be like, all right. And we would start playing short form games. And it was very awesome. It was wonderful. And I was very lucky to have that. But, you know, this comes on the heels of when March hit, and talking to everyone, it was like, oh, all of our work stopped within a 24-hour period. Like everybody I knew that did improv of any sort, corporate improv, anything like that, all those communication workshops, they were all canceled because of the pandemic. So you went from like, I don't know what I'm going to do for work to, wow, this December is the busiest month I've ever had. It was truly unpredictable. But if I didn't have my improv skills that I had to remind myself of like, take a breath, moment to moment, you're in no immediate danger. If I didn't have those skills, I would have been much more panicked, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely something to that. It can help with anxiety quite a bit, for sure. I think that's why the online virtual improv, like jams and whatnot, even internationally, have really blown up. Like, there's just so much of it happening right now. And it's like wild how it's become so globally connected.
Yeah. I mean, to me, the silver lining of the pandemic is the fact that it shrunk this global community for improv. And my friend David Escobedo talks about it's now a, you know, it's this ecosystem. It's no longer like improv communities. It's this one big ecosystem of improv. And, you know, like some of the people you've had on your podcast were people that were also taking advantage of this global improv setup from, you know, places like Bangalore, India is exploding with improv talent, which I don't know if would have been discovered as quickly had there not been this pandemic, where then people were scrambling to make connections. And then you find people in India and you find people in, you know, Copenhagen and in you know, Mexico and all throughout the world. And all you have to do is turn on your computer, fire up, connect to the modem, and you'll find an improv workshop or show happening at all hours of the day.
Yeah. Absolutely. Literally 24 hours a day, you could probably find some improv. I mean, this morning, speaking of Bangalore, I was sitting and listening to their, they were doing just a little chat about how improv has been going for them, like this morning while I was cooking breakfast. I was like scrolling through Facebook as I was making eggs, and then I was like, oh, this is fun. And I just put it up and listened to them chat about how improv's been going for them and what they've been doing and the fun they had in the show the night before. And I was like, oh, this is so nice. You know, and it's like so great to be connected to all these people and to be like involved and get to like be in on what they're happy about and what things are going well. And like, you know, sometimes they're talking about what's not going well. And I'm fascinated by all of the threads that have been, you know, sort of international improv threads about like, what can we do to make this better? What's our effort to make this better? And I'm like, yeah, guys, we're solving all the problems.
And it's, you know, it's a long time coming, honestly. Like a lot of the situation have been given lip service for years. It's like, yeah, we'll make those changes. We'll do that. But there was no incentive to do it. And now, thankfully, there are lots of substantial changes being made, and that goes from it's a combination of, unfortunately, some theaters just closing and there are no gatekeepers anymore. But it also comes, I think, from the ones that are staying open or new ones that are coming on the scene that are making a stance and saying, this is something that's important to us. Inclusion is something that's important, and not just like we're going to get one person of color on our team. It's like, no, let's open this up and look at ourselves and go, what do we need to do to change? What do we need? What are we talk about being inclusive. We talk about improv embracing, but then do we really show it? And so it's taking a look inside and saying, what can we do to make these changes? And now you have no excuse to not reach out to people. You have no excuse to tune in and listen to what people have to say. And there are so many of these wonderful panels that have been happening where it's like, hey, if you want to learn and change, there's opportunity, and most of it is free. So you can sit there and learn and change. And that's the only way that improv is going to thrive, is when it changes and grows. And we should get rid of stuff that we don't need anymore and let go of that which doesn't serve us. And a lot of the old ways just don't serve us right now. And so we can get rid of that and we can make brand new decisions and make new changes, because the virtual space is like the Wild West where there are no rules and there are no gatekeepers. And because of that, a lot of great innovation is happening. And I think a lot of growth is happening as well.
Mm-hmm. I think there's been a big opening of minds about format and style and whatnot. Like, I had done international interviews prior to the pandemic. And, you know, one of the big things that when I was talking to people in Europe, there'd be this like, oh, well, there's American improv and that's about comedy, but that's not what we do. And now it's less so. I hear less of disdain for the comedy. And I feel that what is great about it is that people have been able to play so with so many different kinds of people that they're able to mix and match. And it doesn't have to be like, oh, what are we playing here? Chicago style? Or, oh, what is it that we're doing? Okay, we're doing long form. Oh, we playing certain games from Comedy Sports? You know, like, it doesn't have to be this group's or that group's, or, oh, this style or that style. It's like, and there's some where it's like, yeah, this is the format, this is how it works. But I find that the mix between in a show, you know, of like, this one's a really, you know, longer dramatic scene. Oh, here's a funny one. Oh, that's cool. And you get that a lot more with these, you know, global improv shows that you're seeing.
Totally. And you start looking at those areas and you go, oh, like people in like Asia play status a lot more than they do in the West. Oh, that's interesting. And you start opening up and going, how do you play this game? We play it this way. And also what's interesting to me is I go, I hear the phrase Chicago style improv a lot. And I'm always like, at first I thought I knew what they meant and I'm from Chicago. So I'm like, oh, I think I know. And it's so, somebody told me once, oh, it's fast. Somebody else once told me it's a slower. Somebody told me it's relationship. Someone said it's gay. So there's so many different definitions of what that style is to people.
Totally.
That you now have an opportunity to go, let's invite these people. And the Hideout is doing a great job of this. They're inviting people, and they've been doing it for a long time virtually, is they are inviting people to come play like their sets and say, hey, come play this show with us or come do this with us and bring your, not just play our style, bring your style into the show. And to me, that's what's the thrilling part is, you know, I do a series of these 10-minute scenes and I want to do them with people so they play their style. I don't want them to play like a style they think I want to play. It's a selfish thing for me. I want to experience how they play. And I say anything goes. So I really like trying to play with that person rather than saying, here's how we're going to play.
Mm. It's really fascinating to me, you know, when you talk about the way that you play and the way that you look at improv, you do very much have sort of like, and I don't mean this in a weird way, but like a low status place for yourself in it. You're serving your scene partner. You're working for them, you know? And, you know, I find that when you're a teacher, you don't often get the opportunity to do that because when you jump into a scene, people are like, oh, this is the teacher. They know what to do. Lead us, teacher. You know, and you're like, no, you guys do whatever. I'm just here to like add some spice, you know? And they're like, oh no, she's a spice merchant. That's the scene that we're doing now. This is a great scene. I love it. You make great choices, teacher. And you're like, no, it's not. You know what I mean? So how do you maintain this? Like, how are you serving the scene? How are you, you know, helping people out when I'm sure, especially with your series, people must enter into it with you as a high status person. So how is it that you're able to juggle that?
Well, after each scene, I go, and that's how it's done. And then I hang up. I mean, I did. That's it. And then I never talk to that person again. I'm like, yeah, once. I think for me, I believe it. I'm always want people to know whether, like, especially if I'm teaching, I go, this is not the way to do it. I don't have answers. I'm just going to give you like, sometimes I'll try to help you to where I think you're trying to go, but by no means do I have the answers, you know, by no means should you look to me to say that's how it's done. You know, this is like a cafeteria, like take what you can, leave the rest. I also tell people, and I believe, and this is true too, nothing I say is original. It's things I've curated and heard other people say that I go, that makes sense to me. So when I share that, I try to keep that in mind, and I always try to stay open, and I always want people, to me, the gauge of a good improviser is, do they want to play with me again? That's the big thing, is like, I hope people want to play with me again. That's my number one goal as I improvise. Is like, I hope it's such a great experience that people will want to come back and play again. And I really do mean that. And it's something that, you know, I think you have to, if you're in that situation, you have to just keep reminding the students or the people who don't have as much experience or who put you in that higher status role of like, I don't know anything more than you do. In fact, most of us, we don't want to know anything when we're up here. So please don't think that what we're doing is the right. We have no idea how this is going to turn out. And so the difference between me and other people is not talent. It's I've just got more experience doing this. I've just done more scenes probably. And I hold on to my scenes less dearly. I expect the scenes are going to turn out fine. And I think you get to a point in your improv journey, sometimes it's early on, where you're so afraid of what's like, I want the scene to be so good. I'm so afraid of what's going to happen that it won't be good. And I think eventually you just kind of go into scenes going, oh, this will be fine. We're going to be fine. This is going to be a fun scene. And so when you can help people realize, don't put me on that pedestal of knowing what to do in a scene, because I just want to play like you, and the two of us are going to figure this out together. And that to me is the joy of improv. So sometimes you have to remind people of that. And before I do a 10-minute scene with someone online, I just like to say hi, and I like to be like, hey, is there anything you don't want to like, is there anything you don't want to play? You know, some people are like, and I don't do this usually, but some people might be like, oh, I don't make me do accents. And like, I don't want people to do things they don't want to do. The only time I will have fun with someone is if I know they're going to have fun with me, but then I also know they're going to come back and make me do something even more challenging than I want them to do. So I never want to put people in a position where it's like, look at this jerk, everyone. I always want people to be like, no, I got your back. And I take that literally. Like, I really mean it when I say I got your back. I mean, like, whatever your idea is, let's go with it. And so I try to continue to have that mindset of being open. You know, when something I was told early on, which stuck with me, is like, everybody's idea is better than yours. And I really think that's a good idea to have. It's like, oh my gosh, all these other ideas are so much better. Let me see if I can pile onto their idea rather than pushing my idea forward.
Yeah. That must be nice. I like the idea that you're able to put people at ease, and then they're like, yeah, let's just have a fun time with Jay. It's going to be a good time.
And then it is. And then, you know, I mean, that thing of, Let's go into the scene relaxed and be open to what's going to happen has always worked out well for me, to be like, oh, okay, I'm open for anything. I'm going to have as much fun as I can in this scene. And then when the scene's over, that's it. Like, I don't want to revisit the scene. You know, I a phrase that I love reminding myself of is like, hey, of all the scenes I've ever done, that was one of them.
Right.
And, you know, it's like, you have so many more scenes left inside of you. If you are putting pressure on yourself for every scene to be great, every line to be a home run, funny line, it's not going to come. And my friend Tony Llewellyn said this phrase, he goes, I release and destroy my need to do a good improv scene. And that's an awesome phrase.
I release and destroy my need to do a good improv scene. Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't that great? Where it's like, don't just release it, destroy it. It's like, that's no longer an option. And once you do that, you're like, oh, wow. It frees me up so much to just get back to playing. You know, we didn't get into an improv class to make it stressful on ourselves. But the more classes you take, or the more you, you know, do shows or what have you, sometimes you lose sight of why you got into improv, and it was because it was fun. That's the reason you come back, is like, that was a fun class. And as a level one teacher, you just said it. You're doing that for people. You're introducing them to new friends, which has become this fun thing. And you're allowing them to be themselves. And it's like, not only have fun, but bring that weird part of you out. Cause we're all weird, and it's a good thing. And we should celebrate being that. When somebody in an improv scene says, this is weird, I hate that, because nothing should be treated as that. That's a lazy response to something, is by going like, this is the weirdest date I've ever been on. It's like, no, don't make it that. Make it the most wonderful date you've been on. Make things normal that appear weird. That's the fun challenge. But when you go to a class or a show, bring that side of you, that unique oddball. You know, we used to call it the Isle of Misfit Toys, us improvisers. We never really fit anywhere. We weren't quite stand-ups, you know. We weren't like the class clowns. We were kind of the people whispering to the class clown, like we were adjacent to the class clowns. And then in improv, you find people like you, and you find those people who are like, oh, I also feel that way. And you find that connection with another human being that you might not have found or given them the chance to. You might not have given them the chance to show off who they are so you could connect with them.
Yeah. Yeah, when you do improv and when you walk into an improv theater, at least the ones that I've had been part of in my classes anyway, you know, you want to feel warm. You want to feel protected. Yeah. You want to feel like this actually is a safe space. Like the phrase safe space gets a bad rap. You know, it's all politicized. But realistically, people can't be creative unless they feel comfortable. Yeah. Right. So I seek to just create an environment in which people feel comfortable. You know, it stinks that there are a lot of theaters that, you know, that's not their effort. Right. Like even not to talk smack about UCB, God rest their soul. But but like, you know, a lot of that had a lot to do with, you know, pushing it out to make television or get famous. I mean, like, let's be clear. From the point of view of myself, who is not a Chicago improviser, an improviser from Austin, Texas, UCB and the idea of getting famous through UCB was like, yeah, that's a thing. Right. And now it's like definitely not a thing. And also, like, why would I even, what would that even, how, like, that's not even what I would want to go into it. Now that I've done improv, like, I can't imagine being the kind of person who'd be like, well, I want to work in television, so I've got to take this class. So I don't know. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I don't understand. First off, I don't understand why people don't want to have a safe space. I'm with you. It leads to being able to create more. And people are like, you know, you've heard this phrase, too, where someone's like, don't censor me, right? Don't censor. It's like, you know who don't, you know, the people who don't censor themselves, they're called sociopaths. They don't censor themselves. And we need to create this space. The whole point of improv is everybody's welcome. And if there's a topic we don't talk about, it's okay. There's so many other topics we can have fun with that if somebody says, hey, this thing that you brought up, it triggered me. It's like, great. Well, let's not do that. We're here to protect each other. And when you say got your back and then you do the opposite, you're being a real big hypocrite right there. It's like got your back. And then you go on stage and you're like, I hate you. And you're like, well, that was fun. It's like, well, no, it wasn't fun. And, or you go got your back and you go on stage and you do something else inappropriate. It's like, that's not got your back at all. And so we should be having this safe space for people to be able to create and express themselves. And you should, yes, and if you're set up to yes and something, that's not evil. Like, don't set up people to yes and evil. Don't be like, you should have yes anded me. It's like, no, that was super inappropriate. And we did not build the show as an inappropriate show. We build the show as an entertaining show where you're going to come laugh. And you're not providing that as you go. So I think we should. It's incumbent on the leadership in theaters to make it a safe space. And for so many years, there were artistic directors and directors who were able to get away with acting like lunatics because there was some artistic merit to it. It was seen as like, oh, they're a genius. Yeah, but they're also super inappropriate in a way that sometimes people should have been jailed. You know, because of what they were doing was like completely illegal.
Yeah.
But for some reason in this world of improv and in the world of comedy and the world of theater, it's like, oh, it's fine. They're fine. And then they get bounced around from theater to theater, or they go to a different city and they open a theater under a different name. And it's like nobody wants to talk up for years because the people that were also the gatekeepers were doing it. So you couldn't say anything because you're like, I won't get cast or I'll be viewed as a troublemaker. And thankfully, people have been brave enough to come forward and actually put their names out there and say, I'm the one who's saying this. And then that opened the gates for other people to come up and say, yeah, that happened to me as well. But for too long, we did not do, none of that was in check. And then, you know, I worked for a theater that's been around for over 50 years. And for the first probably 50 years or so of its existence, it didn't have an HR department, a multi-million dollar theater. And you're like, well, that's something that needs to change. And then I got to, when I was in LA, I worked for Westside Comedy Theater, and they were the first theater that made us all take anti-harassment workshop. And it was the first time I'd ever taken one. And we were all, I know a lot of teachers have been asking for it for years, and also situations like, how do we handle these situations when it comes up in class, whether it be something that's sexual in nature, whether it be something where it's like I'm dealing with somebody who has a personality issue, whether it is health. I had a student in my class who her throat started swelling up because she had an allergic reaction in class because somebody had peanuts like a class or two before. So I'm like, how do I deal with that? So sometimes we're ill-equipped in situations. So it's good what's happening now is that there is a level of accountability that is happening that we haven't seen before. It's just for some reason moving very slowly at certain places, and that's too bad.
Yeah, but I think to bring it back to the idea that we are far more connected, and that, like David said, it's an ecosystem. There are people on like checking in on that stuff now. There are people all over the country who are like, oh, or the world, never mind the country.
Yeah.
The country is such a small part of the improv world. It like they are aware of where the good guys are, what's happening in different cities, how things work. I mean, also the other lesson to be learned, and every time I bring this up, I feel so cold, but I've been trying to figure out, like, what's the business model of the theaters that lasted? Because I'd love to figure out what the right way to run a theater is. And if it turns out that all the theaters that shut down were LLCs and all the theaters that lasted were nonprofits, that's something to think about. That's something to think about. You know what I mean? Like, how's that work? Yeah. You know, I don't know. You know, so just looking at the ones that opened and closed, like when UCB, both New York and then LA closed, I was like, okay, there's a problem, because it's not for a lack of cash that crowd is. Like, what's going on here? So the idea of it is that running theaters is really hard, and we sort of all have to be together to help each other out to do all the things, where it's like making sure the wackos stay out, and then also like, hey, you're right. Like, the idea of the HR department is amazing. I've never worked at a theater that had an HR department, but I've worked at lots of theaters. You know what I mean?
I think one thing that doomed improv theaters, in my opinion, and UCB and IO are part of this, is they got too big. Like, the physical space, they moved into bigger, in Second City too, they moved into these bigger physical spaces. And I remember they made a huge jump. And then it was like, well, you weren't prepared. In the case of Second City, they made this big jump, but I don't think they had the amount of teachers that could handle that jump. So you were bringing in some teachers who didn't have as much experience and who needed to be trained more. And so that's diluting your product a little bit. In the case of IO, they moved into this big giant space, but then they're in Chicago and they decided to have a beer garden, which is only good for about 2 months out of the year, but they had no parking. And then they had all these classrooms, but you then had a hard time filling them because it was like Krispy Kreme donuts. Krispy Kreme kind of came out of nowhere, and then they were all over the place, and it was too much. And the UCB here in LA opened a second space that was huge, but it was also in an area that wasn't easy to get to, whereas their first UCB's first space in LA was in a pretty kind of hip area, and it didn't have space for people to wait inside, so people had to line up outside. And humans love lines, and they love lining up in lines, and they go, we should go there because there's a line of people, they must know something. And so that's something I do think that benefited them. And then the other thing, if you want to run a theater, is, man, if you can have famous people come out of your training center, people in America will go to that training center because they see that and they think it's a shortcut to get somewhere. So
right?
I think, yeah. And then COVID hit, which none of these theaters were prepared for because they didn't make a transition to taking advantage of the virtual space that we could have done. But it was always like, it can't be done. And it's like, no, we've shown it can be done. It just took a global pandemic to force people to do it. Whereas, were you thinking in terms of what's next, or were you just thinking in terms of, wow, look at all the people coming into our classes right now. We're doing good. And I don't think a lot of theater people ever, and I include myself with this, I was never like, let's go virtual. It was always like, it can't be done. And you had a bunch of people in improv whose basis is SAN saying it can't be done. And then that's what happened.
Yeah. I mean, it seemed like, well, one of the first things I heard when they started doing virtual improv was that it's a totally different animal, that it is not the same kind of improv that you're doing on stage. It has a different vibe. You have to speak differently.
Yeah.
You have to give each other more space. No talking over each other. You know what I mean? So
it's the greatest in that sense. You can't, you have to slow down, honestly.
Yeah.
But you know what else?
For it.
Well, yeah, but like, look at musical improv. There's no way you could sing and improvise. Well, okay. You know, look at long form. Long for improv at Second City was like, no, it's used to write sketch. And we teach improv games, and that gets us into comedy and writing sketch and stuff. But improv itself can't be an art form. Then you had theaters that came along like IO that said like, no, I think it could be an art form. And then it became an art form. But you always had to have somebody kind of leading that way. And there were attempts made, like Amy Gerlich was one of these early e-learners. A couple of years ago, she tried it, but people just, again, weren't ready. And Kevin Riome did a series called Improv. It was like over iPhones. And he recorded people on, it was like FaceTime Improv, I think is what it was called. And it was two improvisers on FaceTime, and he recorded it and put it out there. And it was like, okay, but we have a tendency as improvisers at times to like put the brakes on when it's like, no, we should be doing this and we should be leading the way and we should be going, okay, here's something new. And you're right. It's not the same, but that's the exciting part. You still use some of the same skills, but it's like improvising on, for film. You're not going to have that audience there, but it can still be done. And the fact that it forces people to slow down and not talk over each other, we've been trying as teachers to get that for years. So I'm excited by it. I'm also excited by the possibility. It's like, okay, what's next? What's the next iteration? Can we fuse this with stage in front of an audience? What about the, augmented reality? And what about that space? And what about virtual? Can we do like, and Roy down in Hideout is doing a lot of stuff. He's looking into the whole, virtual, Oculus, all that stuff. And so I think it's a possibility, and there are people, trying to move forward with this and going, no, it's not a stopgap. It's another way to improvise. And, Katie Shute and Chris Mead are doing the Improv Place, which is the first training center dedicated to online improv exclusively. And they're doing a lot of stuff there over in the UK, and they're looking at this like an opportunity. So as improvisers, our mindset of looking at things as an opportunity, and yeah, what if we need to apply that to this virtual space too and go, yeah, it's not, don't try, stop trying to make it like what it's not, and embrace the technology and go, ooh, I can do stuff on camera now. Okay, cool. I can move around my space. Ooh, I can take this around my house. What if I step off camera? What if I get really close to the camera? What if I get far away? Okay, I can play status using this visual element. So I think it's a world of opportunity. And for some people, they don't want to embrace it, and that's fine. But at the same time, don't bring the party down for other people who are into it.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to ride the train. We didn't invent it. This is what's happening, and we're just dealing with it. It's interesting how, the pandemic has opened up a lot of people's minds to using technology for art. Because now art is entirely online. I mean, there's just no way to do it in person anymore. And so there's all these, like, not starving artists, but starved artists who are just trying to create something. And, like, they just don't know what to do or how to do it. So they've taken to the internet. I can't tell you. I never taught an online writing class in my life. And then all of a sudden I was teaching, you know, 10 people in a writing class and, like, you know, doing comedy sketches through Zoom. And it was like, wow, okay. I guess that's a thing we can do.
But think about now, you have a global reach for students. You can teach people all around the world, not just people in Austin, right? So you have an opportunity to affect people. And I think it's bringing, it's showing that there are so many talented directors, coaches, teachers that aren't just coming from LA, Chicago, New York. They're coming from all over. And Austin's been one of those, like, sleepy, underappreciated improv cities. And people are now starting to see, wow, there is a lot of talent coming from all over. So you don't need to go, oh, I've trained at Theater X. I've trained in this city. You know, Chicago people get this really wonderful but unearned recognition and unearned validity because it's like, oh, you're from Chicago, which makes me laugh. It's like, sure, but that doesn't necessarily because of that mean someone's a better teacher or performer than someone else. It's just like they're in a geographic location. That's it. That just happens to be known for improv. But this opportunity now, people from all over the planet, you can teach classes and it's like, oh, I have a person from Europe. I have a person from Asia. I have a person from South America. I got three people from New York. Like, you can have a mix of students, which also opens up your experience. It opens up your point of reference. Like, it's making these jumps in diversity even go faster. And you start to now connect with people all over the globe that it wasn't possible to do so financially before this.
Yeah. And I knew a handful of people that were doing the traveling. And I was like, man, I'm never going to get to do that traveling like those people. My lifestyle is just not jet setter. Like, cannot just jump on a plane and go for the weekend to Munich. Like, nope. So, but now I can totally, like you said, I can teach a whole, you know, sketch group in Amsterdam if I want. I can have classes in Tokyo. Like, who knows? Or I can have people from all over taking a class all together, right? You never know. That's the wild thing.
That's the wild thing. And they might go, the folks in Tokyo might go, hey, Amy, listen, the pandemic's lifted. You strike a chord with us. We're bringing you out to teach us in an intensive for a couple of days. You tell us when. Like, there is that possibility as people are hearing and they go, oh, we're not going to keep hiring the same eight people that are constantly on these circuits teaching improv or sketch or anything like that. It's like, no. We now have a possibility to bring people in who are better teachers and who are less expensive teachers, but they're better and they're pushing the envelope with this and they're really amplifying people's voices and letting people find their voice in this situation. So I do think, like, you know, in a selfish way, this pandemic has really pushed, you know, the silver lining is the fact of where it's pushing us to go and how it's pushing us to grow as artists in a situation that we never had faced before.
Yeah. So I have one final question for you. You have been teaching improv for many years. You're deeply ensconced in the world, the community of improv. This sounds great. This sounds like a life we all want to lead. How do we do it? What advice do you have for students who are like, I want to do that. How do I get involved? How do they do what you do?
Think Nike. Just do it. Really, just do it. Like, what do you want to do? You want to teach improv? All right, go find somebody who wants to take an improv class, reach out to friends and family and say, hey, can I teach a Zoom class of improv exercises for you? When I wanted to teach on Zoom, I reached out to a friend and I go, and I got 8 people in a class and I go, I want to do a beta class. I don't know how Zoom works. Will you come in? And I'm going to stumble through this, but I want to learn this technology. So it's the same thing. Nobody has the right answer. Nobody knows what they're doing. It's degrees of confidence, and fake confidence or real confidence, it's the same thing. And so what you need to do is be active. Do it. Like, you want to be a performer? Great. Put up a show. Do it over Zoom. When the pandemic lifts, do it in your backyard. Go to a bar that's empty on a Monday night and say, can we use that corner of your bar right there and bring people in? Like, it's all about doing. And that's one thing I learned in Chicago, is it is a city known for doing stuff. And then I get to LA and there's a lot of waiting because people were waiting for a callback. They were waiting for a series. They were doing a lot of waiting for other people to tell them that they're good and that they can do it. And you don't need that permission from anyone. Just do it and get yourself around people who lift you up. It's easy to get around people who will bring you down. And it's like, find those people who it's your tribe, your ensemble, who make you feel valued and who go, yeah, that's great. Let's do that. Like, find those people. I look at somebody like, I always reference Adam Sandler. And whatever you think of him, he's living the dream, which is somebody paying him a lot of money to play with his friends and create with his friends. It doesn't matter the content. It doesn't matter if you think he's funny or not. He's living a life of creating with his friends, and that's all I want to do. And so in order to get there, you just have to keep doing it. Don't make the focus the end. Don't make it the finish line. The joy is in the journey along the way. Allow yourself to fail. Allow yourself to go out there and fall on your face. And then just do it again. But really, just do it. There's no one that you need permission from, and there's no one to stop you. Do what you think is good. Do what you think is funny.
Oh, man. I love asking people's advice because it fills me with such like confidence and new ideas. I'm like, yeah, just do it. It's amazing. You got to get out there. I mean, I'm fully backing you up. I mean, think about, you mentioned if you can't be waiting for somebody to put you on their series, you got to do your own stuff. Especially these days, but previous to COVID, casting directors and people who are producers of movies aren't just looking for somebody who showed up to the audition. They want somebody who's already got something going, right? It's like the confidence of dating when you already feel like, you know, sort of confident in what's going on. You're like, yeah, I'll get a date or I won't. You know, if you have that ease of confidence, if you go into an audition, if you set yourself up to do a project, you have that ease of confidence, then that is what's going to float you. That's what's going to interest people. They're like, oh, what's that? You're already making your own thing. And you're like, yeah, I mean, I could meet with you guys again next week, but I'm pretty booked. I'm sorry. Maybe 2 weeks from now. And they're like, what? You can't meet with me? I love it. You're busy. You know, like the vibe of it gets out there, gets you more work.
You know, people would ask me, how do I get on stage at Second City? And I'd say, you know how you get on stage at Second City? Go do other projects. Then they hear about you and they view you as competition, but they also see you're doing stuff. And that's how you get a Second City stage. It's not putting all your eggs in the basket hoping they ask you. It's like, no, write your own show, do your own thing. And like you said, when you tell somebody I'm busy, it makes you more attractive. So do your thing. And people will start hearing about it.
Totally. Jay, it has been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Oh, my goodness. Are you kidding me? The pleasure was all mine. First off, I'm a big fan. And I've listened to your episodes. And there are so many great people on there. Some people I had known. And then some people I had never heard of. But I think what you're doing is Amy, what you're doing is really good, not just for the improv community, but there's also great lessons for people in life. So thanks for having me on.
Oh, thanks. You're so sweet. I really appreciate that.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.